Dr. Harry Edwards. He's professor emeritus of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Edwards, thanks for joining us today. We just finished a conversation with Evander Kane of the San Jose Sharks, who was one of the athletes on ESPN this morning, who had some very powerful words regarding the murder of Floyd George or George Floyd in Minneapolis. And I was Jalen Rose also had some powerful words about it as well, talking and essentially the line was, look, there's an expectation that African American athletes speak up here and stand up here, but both of them in different ways said, hey, you know what, we kind of need some help here, and not just on social media, but we kind of need some help here as well. It's a question I've struggled with a lot in this situation, because, look, I don't expect everybody to feel the same way about everything. I don't expect everybody to feel that they have to stand up and make a statement every time something happens. But is there any such thing here, Dr. Edwards, as a right way for athletes to respond here? Is not responding or not stating your piece bad?
A non-response is a response. Under these kinds of circumstances and conditions, silence is evil's greatest ally. And I think that when the problem exists within a community, a particular community, and the people who are most representative of that community publicly have nothing to say about the problem, then that's a way of taking a stand literally in support of the problem. So when you have a situation that's generated by a history of white supremacy, sustained by white privilege, enforced by white institutional racism, and then you have whites who are the most representative of that community in terms of a public platform. It's a platform where, unlike doctors or lawyers or politicians, people literally pay to go in and see them do what they do. You don't pay to see a doctor do what he does, or a lawyer do what he does, or an engineer do what he does. That's the most public and probably influential platform in modern society. And for them not to make a statement is to make a statement. They're siding with the problem. And there's an obligation, because it is essentially a problem born of generations of white privilege, white supremacy, institutionalized racism, and so forth, and they have an obligation to speak out on it.
It's well said, Dr. Edwards. We're coming up on the 52nd anniversary of the Olympics in Mexico City, and your Olympic Project for Human Rights. I think certainly people in Canada and certainly in the United States know about John Carlos and Tommy Smith. After that, Rodney King, Ferguson, Kaepernick, and there's a million other race riots that I can name in the United States. And here we are again today. You must be exhausted, Dr. Edwards, because it seems like we continue to, for whatever steps we take forward, we continue to take some steps backwards.
No, I'm not exhausted. I'm not even tired, because I understood something from the outset. Someone asked me in 1968, after Jackie Robinson, and now we have this protest in Mexico City, none of it makes any difference. Why do you continue to press this issue? Because I understood from the outset that the struggle that we're dealing with is perpetual, and our effort, therefore, must be tireless, and there are no final victories. So I don't look for this to be the final episode of this dimension of the struggle. In point of fact, I'm more concerned about the confluence of a whole bunch of other factors than I am about the immediate impact of the George Floyd lynching. And that is this, that we are now facing the possibility, if not the likelihood, of a extended summer of racial unrest in American society, at the same time that we're facing a resurgence of a pandemic's impact that has already taken more lives in this country than any other nation on earth, at the same time that resurgence takes place, is projected to take place, assuming that it doesn't take place sooner, in September to October. We're also facing a hurricane season where there's already a projection of five hurricanes, four of which could be rated four or higher. So at this point, we're looking at people in the streets, crowding the hospitals, packed off in shelters, and so forth, with leadership at the national level that we'd be better off without. And so at the end of the day, I'm more concerned about where this thing is headed in terms of what I already see this side of the horizon than about the specific incident that will not be resolved anytime soon that's going on in Minneapolis. I think we have to take that perspective, and under those circumstances, we can't afford to get tired.
You know, Harry, this week, obviously, we watched someone murdered before our eyes, lynched, as you said, on a more banal, but, part of the same continuum. I was just reading Ellie Mistel's piece on The Nation, where he pointed out that, among other things, in New York, the NYPD, 81% of the people they've cited for social distancing violations during this pandemic have either been Black or Latino. And I'm hearing a bunch of voices in my head from friends saying, why are you surprised? You can be horrified by these things, but really, you're surprised? I wonder, how do you, and not to mention everything you just cited, I understand anger, but how do you ward off despair?
Well, you don't become, when the option is death, you don't let despair and discouragement and so forth get in the way of struggle. I was in line, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, the distance between whites and blacks. I was in line outside of a Whole Foods store because everybody has to be a certain distance apart and wear a mask and everything. So we're standing there, and there's a white guy immediately in front of him. And he turns around and says, this is so, this wears you down. It tears you down. You have to go out. You don't have any option because you got to go get the food and everything and so forth, gas up. And every time you go out of the house, you realize you could get killed. This wears me down. I said, well, welcome to a ubiquitous feature of black life in American society. And he looked at me like he was seeing the sun for the first time. He got a sense at that point of what I dealt with every single day that I walk out of my house. And if a police car pulls into the cul-de-sac where I live and stops anywhere near my house, I'm looking out the window. I'm trying to figure out what's going on, because cops have come into the homes of black people and shot them to death in their homes. And so at the end of the day, you don't get tired. There's no despair where you're up against that kind of situation. It's like, don't you feel despair on the battlefield? I've never heard of a soldier that felt so much despair on the battlefield that he gave up fighting for the lives of himself and his fellow soldiers. You can't do that. And that's the level of life of black people in American society. Whites don't know it. They don't feel it. They deny it. They duck it. They cover it up. They bury it. And all other kinds of things. And the thing that has happened now, especially in this climate of anxiety created by this pandemic, is that everybody has to look in the mirror. And I've seen white reporters on television crying as if they're seeing something that they have seen for the first time.
I'll ask you, how should we react? How should those of us in the media react, Dr. Edwards? How should those of us in the media who are white react to this?
You know what I tell my white friends? You should react the same way you would react if I was in your place and you were in mine. Because a lot of times when whites ask, what should I be doing? They know what the issues are. The issues are white supremacy. The issues are racism. The issues are white privilege. The issues are that the police and municipal areas were established as part of the mechanism for enforcing the fugitive slave laws in American society, and in Canada, as far as that's concerned, in some instances. And so that history is there. They've avoided that history. They've denied that history. They've refused to look at that history. They refused to deal with that history. And then they turn around and ask black folks, what should I do? And if I say, you got to give up the privilege. You got to be honest about the history. You've got to give up the white supremacy. You've got to give up the notion that somehow being white gives you privileges and security and protection that those who are not white don't have. They look like, I can't do that. You know, so my answer to that has always been the same. What would you do if you were in my shoes? What would you demand? What would you seek? What would you insist upon? What would you struggle for? What would you work for? Always with the understanding that you cannot become so preoccupied with your own challenges that you sacrifice your humanity and can't see the humanity even in those who are afflicted with the privilege and the racism and the history of denying history. You can't sacrifice your own humanity to that extent. You've always got to be looking for allies and friends and so forth. So that's my response to that. And it's okay if it takes you some time. I watch people who have looked in the mirror for the first time in the wake of witnessing what happened in terms of the lynching of George Floyd. And it broke them up because for the first time they realized this is what black people have been talking about for generations.
Do you think, Harry, that's in part because it's finally enough to shake off the kind of liberal complacency, the notion that you could, that's the, you know, kind of the myth of progress, that you would look back and, you know, Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit and you say, boy, wasn't it awful back then, or Emmett Till, my God, that was horrible, thank God we have advanced and progressed, that finally this is enough to shake that off while ignoring Oscar Grant,
while ignoring Trayvon Martin, while ignoring Eric Garner, while ignoring Aleanna Jefferson, who was shot to death in her living room while playing a video game with her nephew by a police officer in a wrong house bus. I mean, so, yeah, while ignoring all of that. And I don't think this is going to shake white America loose from its attitude of supremacy and its addiction to privilege. I think that this is a ongoing struggle. It's going to be incremental, and it's going to be white America. It's going to be white folks who change white folks because they don't believe black folks. They never have believed us. They haven't believed us since the slave master said, my slaves are happy, and the slave said, I want to be free. They have dominated definitional authority. They continue to hold on to that because not to hold on to it means that they've got to look into the mirror and say, look at what we have become. And that is a fearsome photo. I mean, this is a fearsome challenge that whites are up against, and I understand that, but they have to continue to struggle to get that done. I'm impressed by the number of white kids, white young white folks I see out there in the streets in Minneapolis, young white women out there. Even if they're shielded somewhat by their privilege, they're out there. They're trying to understand. They're trying to make a change. I am deeply appreciative of that. But will that change the structural foundations of what we saw with George Floyd? Not immediately. It's going to be a long-term, ongoing struggle.
Harry, does today's younger athlete who's grown up in a more multicultural era, who see people like LeBron James and Colin Kaepernick speak out, do they give you hope for being part of this activism heading forward?
Oh, I always have hope. I love LeBron, Carmelo Anthony, D. Wade. His statements on sex and gender and his daughter and what that meant to this society in terms of him and his wife standing up and saying, yes, we love her. even more. I think that CP3, I think these athletes are making contributions, but you can go back to the turn of the 20th century. You can go back to 1896 when Major Taylor insisted on racing in cycling the same year that Plessy versus Ferguson edict came out of the Supreme Court establishing segregation as the law of the land. You can go back to that point. Athletes have always been involved in this struggle. That's what the Negro Leagues was, a resistance movement. Plessy versus Ferguson wasn't about separate but equal. Those words are nowhere in the edict. Plessy versus Ferguson was about pushing black people back as close to slavery in terms of subjugation, subsistence, and subordination without calling it slavery. And so the Negro Leagues was a resistance movement. What you saw with Jack Johnson was a resistance movement. Paul Robeson was involved in a resistance movement. And, of course, we go right on up to Jackie Robinson and desegregation, and then a third wave of athlete activism with Smith and Carlos and Jim Brown and Bill Russell and Arthur Ashe and most certainly Curt Flood and that group. And all sparse through there, you have women like Althea Gibson who are saying, I, too, am an athlete. So there's a history of this. And what this generation is doing is following through on that history, and we're lucky, we're blessed to have people like Carmelo Anthony and like LeBron James and like D. Wade and CP3 and some of these other great athletes, Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed and Malcolm Jenkins and all of these, Mike Bennett and all of these great athletes who put their careers and in many instances their lives on the line to say, we are better than this.
Dr. Edwards, your words are always illuminating. Always learn something when we have you on. We never tire of it. We thank you so much for doing this, and stay safe, and we'll be chatting again. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you. You brothers, stay safe up there and be well.